This week on Family Anatomy, anatomy of three things.
Hosts of Family Anatomy are psychologists, but they're not your psychologists. So if you want to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you can get a referral from your family doctor. This show is for information only.
Hello and welcome to Family Anatomy, your source for parenting and relationship information, with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spizzano
and Dr. Brian McDonald. You can find us at familyanatomy.com or check us out on iTunes. And we're doing something tonight that we haven't done in a long time.
Top three research things.
Three research stories that we thought were interesting in the last little while. Now, we're recording a little bit ahead of time, so these might be old news by the time you've heard them, but we thought they were really interesting, and I brought a story today about, well, let's hear yours first, actually. There was one that you really liked.
Let's do that, but before we do that, the name of the show, Top Three Things.
Well, anatomy of three things.
Three things. It could be a lot of different things. You know what's interesting
about
it? We had
a moratorium on three things, Joe.
We did. Except this is not a joke.
Okay.
This is serious. I'm being very serious now.
Please.
Three things. What is this? This is a podcast about families, couples, kids, right?
There's three little characters on our logo.
There's three little characters on the logo. And things makes me think of Dr. Seuss. Right,
thing but
one
only,
and thing two.
There were only two things.
Was there thing three? There was
only two things.
We're kind of riding on the back of that original thing, one thing, two thing.
The coattails thing. Of the Cat in the Hat.
Yes.
That's what we do best.
That's what we do.
Riding on the coattails of more successful others.
That's right. I bet. And now, the thing three, he should have thought of that, right? But we did.
So we invented it.
We invented that, thing three.
There we go. Perfect. Three
Not
things.
Dr. Seuss, Dr. McDonald, Dr. Spizzano.
Okay, well, that's it. We're done. And that's our show.
That's our half an hour show.
It's a quick one. Wow. But okay, tell us about your first story. Don't go into the whole thing. Let's tease it a little bit first. What kind of thing are we going to talk about tonight?
The first story is going to be on revenge.
That's interesting.
Okay. Just the word itself is interesting.
I wonder what kind of research we found about revenge.
Yes.
How can we turn the interesting concept of revenge into a history lesson, Giuseppe? Let's find out.
I don't know, but I know that you're on board with the history now. I know that.
I am. I'm right on top of that history business. It's my New Year's resolution. The story I brought was really kind of about social development and getting back to talking about kids and teenagers again, and about the when youth move from grade 6 to grade 7, when they're moving from elementary school to middle school, and how their friendships affect their performance at school.
Another interesting story.
I thought so.
And the last story, something that's been on the news a lot in the last month or two, is, last month or two in particular, because it's so controversial, but I guess it's about Dr. Wakefield.
Dr. Wakefield, and all of the controversy surrounding the, well, recent, as we're recording this, developments published in the British Medical Journal about his original 1998 study concerning the link between autism
and the MMR vaccine.
Exactly. Well, let's get on with the first one. Let's talk about revenge.
Revenge.
Is this our Halloween episode?
We should have saved this
revenge.
One. We should have saved this for Halloween, but we did not.
No, we didn't. We don't time things very well that way because we don't have very good executive functions.
Here's the thing, though. This is from the European Journal of Social Psychology.
It is.
And who knows? Maybe in Europe, it's Halloween right now. Do you know that? I don't know that.
No, this is Germany. Do they even celebrate Halloween in Germany? These are all German researchers from universities in Germany.
So there you go.
Gollwitzer, Meder, and Schmidt.
That's right. That's right.
I don't know if I'm saying that right. My wife is German, though, so I'm sure she'll correct me at home when she listens to this.
Well, what you should do is just edit out your pronunciation and just put your wife's voice in those three words.
We'll fix it in post.
Okay. So, revenge. What kind of a research can you do on revenge? Well, they figured it out.
They did. Really, what they were doing was testing a couple of different ways of understanding revenge. What they wanted to know was, do people feel better after getting revenge? And if they do, why?
Right. And they had two different hypotheses. So how do you feel better after revenge? One hypothesis is that there's they call it a comparative suffering hypothesis.
You have such pleasant names.
It's kind of a long term for something that it's pretty commonly understood, really. If you think about it, it's you felt hurt by someone, and you're only going to feel better if you yourself feel that they have been punished to an equal extent as the kind of hurt you felt in the beginning. So it's kind of...
Wow, that was more confusing
to me.
I thought the description in the study, an affective imbalance between the perpetrator and the victim. And that was even more confusing than that.
Yeah,
it's like misery loves company. Somebody hurt you and you're not going to feel better until you hurt them back and they suffer just as much as you did.
That's right. That's right. So that is something about a balance, but you're the one that has to sense that there's a balance, like they suffered as much as you.
Right. Right.
So that's one thing.
And then there's the kinder, gentler understanding hypothesis.
The interesting thing about the understanding hypothesis is that, you know, it could be the exact same punishment as the first example.
That's right.
Right? The exact same thing, except if the perpetrator, the person that hurt you, mm-hmm. doesn't own up to it or understand that the punishment is because of the crime they committed towards you, crime in quotes.
Right.
Right? That's the only way you're really going to feel better if you know that they understand that their punishment was because of what they did to you.
This is because I did something wrong, and that's why something bad is happening to me now. And you have to realize that they're feeling that way before you're going to feel good about getting revenge.
That's right. So it's your you knowing that they understand that this punishment is because of what they did.
Wow. You could talk circles around anything. This is great. This is very good. It's very tricky to do this kind of research because really you have to trick the people that are involved. You have to set up some situation where they're going to want to get revenge against someone. And it's not like you can have a couple come into your office and somehow set up a situation where the husband is going to go home and try to get revenge on his wife for something she did in the office.
That's right.
So what they do instead is, well, they do probably something that you were involved with when you were doing your undergraduate psychology degree, is they recruit students. And they sort of trick them a little bit. It's kind of hard in this day and age to get permission to do this kind of research because you're tricking people.
Yeah, I mean, on the ethical, unethical scale of things, this is not terribly unethical.
Well, and they debrief them afterwards, and nothing bad happens to anyone. What they did in this case was that they invited a subject into a room and had them write an essay about something, about their experience at university. And then they supposedly had someone else in another room that they never saw or met.
Did not exist, this person.
Who really didn't exist. So they thought there was a partner in another room who was also writing an essay, and then they would trade essays and grade the other person's essay. And the higher grade you got, the more benefit you got at the end. You were getting paid a little bit of money, or you were getting raffle tickets to win a little prize. It wasn't anything really big. And the idea was, didn't matter what the subject in the study wrote, that fake partner who was going to grade their essay was going to give them a bad grade so that they would want to get revenge.
Right. So they set up this kind of hurt their ego a little bit
right.
type of scenario.
Yep.
And then they were going to see what kind of revenge may or may not help. And they would fall into these two categories, the comparative suffering hypothesis versus the understanding hypothesis.
So they set up situations where the person might take revenge, or there might be just something bad happened by fluke or bad luck, so that it might not necessarily be related to anything the person did. And some of the subjects in the study got a note from this imaginary partner indicating that they understood that, oh, well, I did something wrong, so I guess I deserve for this bad thing to happen to me, whatever that was.
In response, because the subject had an opportunity in some cases to deliver a punishment back for the hurt that they had received.
And it is really, I mean, I say it, I'm kind of joking and saying Giuseppe's talking circles around it, but when you read the actual study, the way that they manipulated all of this and the different conditions, it's pretty hard to make sense out of what they did.
It's very, very complicated.
Well, but the bottom line, you can read it and understand it, but it's hard to explain in a half-hour podcast. It is.
But here's the bottom line. Let's go off the study just for a second and take a more everyday example, but extreme examples.
Up close and personal with Giuseppe.
Might make this more intelligible, let's say. So someone has done you a great wrong and hurt you or your family, and they, let's say, get the death penalty. Okay? Oof. Let's make it an extreme real-life example. If that person that could lose their life, or even someone that goes away for 20 or 30 years, if that person just gets that penalty without saying, I understand that this sentence that I've received is because of the wrongs that I've committed, if they don't say that, the satisfaction, the feeling of revenge is not there as much as if the person actually takes responsibility and says, I understand that this is why I'm being punished this way, because of the hurt I've caused you. So the understanding hypothesis wins out in this study.
You're foreshadowing a little bit, but yeah, it's true. The people who felt the best were the ones who got a note indicating that the other person understood. And I do kind of wonder, because they didn't really look at this part, would it have been enough just to get like an apology? Or would they have felt just as satisfied if the person who wronged them said, because this is a minor wrong, it's not what you were talking about, a death penalty kind of a situation. It's a minor thing. They gave them a bad grade on an essay. If they came back and said, hey, look, I'm sorry, I was having a bad day. I'm sorry I gave you a bad grade. You probably didn't really deserve it. It's on me. It's not on you.
Well, I guess they didn't go into it to that extent to
well, they were wondering about
out,
revenge, right? The
right,
study is about revenge. It's not just
but,
about...
That's right. But it's interesting, though, because if you think about what happened in South Africa, right, where there was that Truth and Reconciliation Commission, mm-hmm. So there were people, I guess, whites in South Africa that had done a lot of crimes against blacks. And once the tables had been turned and the blacks were in power... rather than necessarily have all these people sent to jail after the fact many years later, instead what they had was this Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which would be in some ways very relevant in terms of the hypothesis that comes out that is supported by this research, that, you know, the people that perpetrated some of these crimes sat in front of their peers, mm-hmm. and said, these are the crimes that I committed, and I take responsibility for them, and I regret and what I did, and so on and so forth.
I think they're trying to do that more in schools as well, right? I mean, you're talking about the very big picture examples, but they're doing some restorative justice kinds of things now in schools, where if there's something that happens where two people are having a conflict, really it's not about punishing somebody. I think increasingly there's less of the just straight punishment and, okay, you're going to get detention for what you did and that's it, that's the end of it. It's much more about trying to understand the other person and encourage empathy, and that understanding hypothesis, again, is coming into play.
And we're back to what we've been talking about for a few episodes now, which is it's about the relationship, which can be, you know, pretty damaged if you're talking about really serious things, but revenge can be in a really small scale, like in the study, or can be all the way to some of these more dramatic things I've been talking about. But there's hurts that happen throughout life in relationships, and that understanding is what makes you feel better when you felt wrong.
It sure seems that way. If this is a result that can be replicated under other circumstances instead of just for a minor wrong among university students, right? If they're able to do similar experiments or similar examinations of those bigger things that happen. But I think it makes sense to me that you're going to feel better if the other person understands what they did wrong.
Right. I mean, if the person understands, I think as the person who's felt wronged, you feel a sense of closure, right? Sure. You feel like it's less likely to happen again because mm-hmm. they understand that they did some wrong and they're taking responsibility. You know, that those are really important things for the person who has felt wronged.
And then there's that relationship part of it, right? And speaking of, here's the clumsy segue into the next story. Speaking of relationships, let's talk about friendships and the transition to grade 7.
Let's do that.
So the move from grade 6 to 7 is a huge one. At least here where we live, the way the schools operate, typically kids are changing schools. They're moving from an elementary school setting into a high school setting. Now the grade 7 and 8 students are usually separated a little bit within the building from the 9 to 12 students, but they're still in the same space. And at the very least, they're still moving to a different school for the most part. There's still a few schools, and I think it's a good model, honestly, the kindergarten to grade 8 schools. I think that's a neat way to go, but there, most of the schools, at least where we live, are grade kindergarten to 6 and then 7 to 12.
Right.
So students are moving from typically a smaller school where they know the staff, and they're moving into a big environment with unfamiliar people. It's an unfamiliar building, and it's with teachers that they don't know. So this is a study in the Journal of Early Adolescence from 2011.
And we should say, so in that bigger school,
yeah,
where they're not going to know the staff as well as they did in their smaller school,
right?
Amongst other factors, peers become more relevant in terms of influence.
Well, that's happening, you know, when you're 12, 13, 14 years old anyway, right? Peers are becoming more and more important, and you're entering that stage of trying to become more independent from your parents. So even without the move to a different school, you're still getting that importance of peers is escalating. The social dynamics are changing. And then you're adding, I guess, the added stress of changing schools when all that is happening and introducing a whole new peer group. So this is a study from the Journal of Early Adolescence by Verano and Dishion in 2011 called Middle School Friendships and Academic Achievement in Early Adolescence. So they were looking at grade 6 students and measuring a whole lot of things about them and then checking in on them again when they were in grade 8 to find out what's going to predict how they're doing at school from grade 6 to grade 8. And they really wanted to know about their friendships. And it's an important thing to study, I think, because there's lots of research out there to say that teenagers, youth, and young adolescents seek out friends who are similar to themselves in some way, similar interests, similar behavior, maybe similar academic achievement, maybe even similar appearance, maybe similar talents and abilities, things like that. And then what happens is they reinforce those things that brought them together in the first place. So they like something about the other person that they see as the same as them, and then they sort of, that similarity that brought them together is kind of what they reward in one another, and then, which is great for, well, they call them conventional friends who sort of engage in pro-social behavior and they're just normal kids. They're going to toe the line increasingly as they get older into high school. It becomes more of a problem with more antisocial kids who are getting together maybe for the wrong reasons because they're reinforcing negative behavior in one another, and that problem behavior can escalate.
That's right. Here's another study that, you know, when you first think about it, seems fairly straightforward. Like you're trying to figure out what kind of influences peers have on academic achievement and involvement with school in the middle school year. So it seemed like you're hoping that's a nice, clear, quick answer that you get from it. And intuitively, people probably have a lot of sense of what that would be. But when you look at the real details of the study, it gets a bit more complicated than that. So, you know, one of the things that came out was that if you're a teen that has friends who are engaged in school, that's going to help you, right? However, if you're a teen who has friends that are engaged in school, but they have problematic negative behaviors, no matter how engaged those friends are, It's not going to help you.
And if those friends are having all of these negative problem behaviors, well, probably they'll become less engaged over time, you would think, at the same time.
You would think.
When we're talking about school engagement, we're talking about things like, are they getting their homework done? You know, how often in the last week did you pass something in on time? Are you playing any sports at school? Stuff like that. So the kinds of things that you do if you're interested in school and want to do well.
Right.
Whereas achievement, when we're talking about the academic achievement, that's the grades that the kids are getting. And then the problem behaviors are the more, you know, skipping school and aggression and all those kinds of things that people think of when they think of high school students.
That's right. So the problem behaviors trump the engagement.
Right. Well, the biggest predictor of all.
But I mean, if you're a parent out there, you're thinking, wow, you know, my child's hanging around with kids who are really engaged in school and really, you know, working at stuff and all that. That's not as important as some of the problem behaviors that the peers of your child are having.
Right, right.
In terms of influence.
Yeah, the problem behaviors had a bigger impact than the school engagement did. The biggest impact was, you know, the people who did better, who were doing better in school in grade 6, they were still doing better in grade 8.
Right.
So these other things with their friends also had some kinds of impact, but problem behavior, if you're engaged in problem behavior, you're less likely to do well.
Right.
But then when you get into the friend stuff, you're right. It's friends' problem behavior is predicting not just negative achievement, but a negative change. So you're going to do worse. Even if you started out bad, you're going to do worse if your friends are getting into trouble. You might do a little bit better if your friends are really engaged and interested in school. But it became a little bit funny when they were looking at girls.
I found this really interesting that, you know, if you have a girl that is high achieving, hanging out with other high achieving girls, something we said earlier, mm-hmm. then it's all good. It's all good for them, right?
Right.
But if you have a lower achieving girl hanging out with a higher achieving girl, the lower achieving girl is actually going to do worse than she would have if she wasn't hanging around with the high achieving girl. Now, so in other words, to me, the idea behind that, or the reasoning that might be behind that, is you don't want to, if your child is a lower achieving child, right, and they're hanging around with higher achieving girls, the discrepancy might be so high there that it's demoralizing. It takes away your motivation. It's that sort of thing that you think about. Like if you were trying to engage any student, right? Mm-hmm. What you want to be able to say is that, you know, they're going to be 75% successful at the task that you're giving them, right? You don't want them to feel 25% successful. That means that you're too far ahead in the curriculum for them.
So they won't be motivated to keep on going.
Demoralized. That's right.
But what I think what you're talking about is something, they even have a name for it, social comparison theory. So you're comparing yourself to your friends. And if you're in your comparison to your friend, you think that their achievement is a goal that you could reach, that you could do as well as them, then you're going to be more motivated and you'll do better.
The interesting thing about the social comparison theory, because there was another related piece of research that I looked at,
mm-hmm.
and it showed that younger kids don't really have that social comparison in the forefront of their minds the same way a little bit older kids do. It's something that sort of develops over time. The younger kids aren't comparing to other kids; they're just comparing to themselves. Mm-hmm. So they'll talk about, "I did really well at this," right? Easily, whereas the older kids, because there's more of a social comparison that happens, like they're like, if they say, "I did really good at something," the kid that's listening to that statement is more likely to wonder about how they're doing in comparison to their friend, and there can be a bad feeling develop because of that. Even if you did well. And so it negatively affects relationships, mm-hmm. and you don't hear it as much. So it's something that develops with age in kids.
And I think the most interesting thing probably about this study is that the kinds of things that happen in friendships that promote academic achievement at that, you know, grade 6 to 8 level aren't learning about specific study habits or getting together with your friends and figuring out how to prepare for an exam. It's about whether or not your friend can stay away from getting into trouble and how much sports and other activities are connecting your friend to school. So it's not specific study habits. It's much more broad than that, I guess you could say. It's
much more broad, and even that there's that emotional component too in terms of being discouraged.
There you go. And now we come to our third story in our three very interesting things episode.
And we'll have nothing really interesting to say about Dr. Andrew Wakefield.
Dr. Wakefield, this just blew me away at the beginning of January when this came out in the British Medical Journal.
Well, it's an incredible story, really.
It's something we've talked about before, right? Is this idea that Wakefield came out with in 98 saying that the vaccinations that kids were getting was causing them to become autistic. And that's why there were so many cases of autism.
And he specifically was looking at the vaccination being particularly bad for kids who were having gastrointestinal problems.
Mm-hmm. That vaccine that they get, is it around 2 years?
Yeah, the MMR.
Right.
So, I mean, he only looked at 12 kids. That's the thing. This 1998 paper that was published in The Lancet, a very well-respected journal in England.
Right.
He only looked at 12 kids.
And
three of the kids didn't have autism. So really, it was 9 kids. Of the 9 kids, I guess there's an investigative reporter that's looked at it within the past few years and even most recently is saying that of the 9 kids that Wakefield said had it, 3 didn't. So really, we're looking at 6 kids.
Wow, it's
like, and I don't know if, and I, when the two of us think about 6 kids, I think it probably means a little bit more than to maybe a lay audience,
mm-hmm.
right? What's the problem with only looking at 6 kids?
Well, because anything could happen with just 6 kids. If you're going to generalize your results to the population, you need to have a sample that you can compare to the general population. And what happened was he saw these, 12 kids in his study all together. And the media got a hold of this idea that, maybe vaccinations are causing kids to become autistic. And it snowballed from there.
It snowballed. And just to go back to that 6 kids for a second, here's an analogy that I think might help people understand. Of course, we're in Canada, so I'm going to use a hockey analogy.
Of course.
Of
please
course
do.
I will. Okay. So there's a goaltender. Okay, that plays for a team and he plays 70 games.
Okay. He's playing for the Toronto Maple Leafs probably, right?
No, it's not my team.
The Canadiens.
So there's 70 games that this goalie plays, okay? And over the course of 70 games, you get a pretty good idea of what kind of goaltender he is because it's not just a one game sample. Okay, like in this research, it's like a 6 game sample kind of thing, right? So over the course of 70 games, you could see, is this a really good goaltender or not? You would not want to rate comparatively how good he is by looking at the goalie who came in just for one game all season, who happened to get a shutout. So no goals were scored against him. And when you look at his statistics, he's got a goals against average of 0. Does that make him a better goalie based on just one game? Guy came from the minors, okay? He had one shot. The team performed really well in front of him because they were worried because he's a minor leaguer. And he played against a soft team. That's why he was in. And he got no goals scored against him. So the guy who's in there for 70 games has a goals against average of, say, 1.5 or 2. Does that make him a worse goalie based on the statistics? I guess if you... You know what I'm saying?
Well,
if you didn't know better, you would say, well, look, that one guy, they never, ever scored on him, but he was only there for 3 periods
year. If we bring it back to the vaccination issue, we're looking at 12 kids out of how many kids are being vaccinated, and he's saying, well, it's causing this problem because I found this in this many kids, but it's this tiny group. And so that was an issue that I think many researchers had with that original study and clinicians had with the original study. And even when we talked way back when with Dr. Jillian Graham-Bevan, who said, you know, there's not a lot of evidence to support it. No one else was able to replicate
those results.
He says someone did, but it wasn't him in his lab. And in fact, when we were doing research for the story, we gathered some information from CNN and from the Globe and Mail and places like that. And those sources are saying, well, the university offered him a year of paid leave in order to replicate the study with the bigger group, and he didn't take them up on that offer.
That's right. And so, I mean, there's so many problems here. I mean, the way he recruited the kids for the study.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about this. So far, we've been talking, if this was a legitimate study with no other problems except for the small sample, what we're saying is the importance of that result was exaggerated because it was such a small group and nobody else could imitate those results.
What we're talking about is the normal curve, right? There's a phenomenon that if you had a lot of kids that you were looking at, then you could get a sense of whether this is a common thing. If you just look at six kids, you cannot generalize from six kids.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
Just that by itself is very, very problematic.
So if the study otherwise was perfect, we would still be saying, well, there's some problems here. And now this investigative reporter is publishing, the British Medical Journal is publishing some of his work that's saying, well, the way that those 12 people in the study were recruited, that was a little bit fishy. Well, maybe more than a little bit fishy. There's all kinds of fishy things about this thing.
There's a lot of fishy things. So there was actually an advocacy group called JABS, I think it was.
JABS. Nice acronym, right?
It was a group against vaccines. And he tapped into that group to try and get his subjects for this. And they had to be kids. And there was a lawyer attached to that group. And they were looking for ways to launch a class action lawsuit.
Yeah, Deere is saying that the lawyer was that the study was paid for by a lawyer who was launching this class action lawsuit, and that the kids were recruited from anti-vaccination activists.
It was a conflict of interest, right? So he's being paid by a lawyer who's looking to launch a lawsuit on behalf of this group and parents.
Again, according to the information that we have coming out of the BMJ.
Right. So allegedly, he would be very motivated to find something. He's being paid by them. And then he's going to be paid as an expert consultant. And in the end, allegation is that he tried to put out an alternative vaccine, which...
Or a test of some kind. There was some other thing that he had a patent on along and was partnered with one of the parents of the kids in the study, which is very unusual as far as we know, which would be very unusual. Him and the father of one of the kids in the study had a patent on some kind of either a test or an alternative vaccine, and he says, no, it was neither of those things. It was some kind of an herbal supplement or something. And he was anticipating, I'm going to make $500,000 off of this.
I mean, there's so many problems with this. The other thing that we didn't mention when we were talking about how he recruited them is that it wasn't a randomized recruitment, right? So in other words, here's another wacky analogy for you.
Is it about hockey again? One?
No, this one's about aliens.
Oh, I thought it was going to be a left winger.
Okay. So aliens come down to Earth, right?
Sure.
And they fall into, and they're doing some research to take back to the mothership, right? And they happen to fall into a group, they crash into this one place, and everybody in this place is part of this vegetarian society. Okay, they were meeting that night. They had a little group, right?
Right.
And they go back and they sit, and based on the six people in that group that night who were all vegetarians, they go back and they tell them, look, they're all vegetarians.
Imagine.
Right? It's not random. Not everybody on Earth is a vegetarian. Not that there's anything wrong with that, by the way.
So
maybe they should all be vegetarians. I'm just saying it's not random.
Right.
And so very skewed results.
So now we're
everybody on Earth is a vegetarian when they're not, because it's not a random sample.
So first off, what we're saying is that we've got this small group of people that you're basing these findings on. Next, we're finding out that the group of people was selected in kind of an unusual way, allegedly selected in an unusual way, from and self-selected from a group who's more likely to give you the results that you want. In addition, there's allegedly a conflict of interest in that this person stands to make a lot of money if the results come out the way that he hopes that they will. And now Brian Deere is also saying, well, even with all of that stuff, there's still more going on.
Falsified records.
Oh my goodness. Falsified records.
Now this is also an interesting point. I mean, The Lancet is a very well respected journal, right?
Right.
Internationally well respected journal. So and it's peer reviewed. So you'd think that if it gets into The Lancet, there's a lot of faith in that article. Right?
Exactly, yeah.
Now the problem is, and I think this is very rare, but there is a problem that researcher, that it's not like the people at The Lancet, the researchers and doctors at The Lancet, are going in and making sure all of his numbers and data add up. You know, they're not looking at his raw data.
And this is the thing.
They have to trust that he hasn't manipulated the raw data.
Well, that's right. And this is the thing about research. And the way that we do research, for those out there who aren't doing it, the way that people do research generally is that your subjects of your research are anonymous. So you're not publishing the names of the people who are involved in your study. That all of that stuff is anonymous. You collect some data, it goes with some kind of an ID code, and then you make your judgments from there. So even if the reviewers of the paper at The Lancet looked at the original data, as far as they're concerned, well, it matches up with what you said. Because he made it up. Allegedly he made it up. Because at the time of the original study, well, they weren't aware when it was published that there were these other connections that were kind of creating the conflict of interest or the non-random sampling that Deere is saying is going on. And then how could they be aware of the fraud? Because there's no way to check the original medical records.
I mean, it's unprecedented, really. He left the university on a really bad note. The university apparently wanted to get rid of him. The Lancet has actually come out and said that his research was fraudulent, not just flawed in terms of methodology, which is something that
they said that before,
but that they can say that researchers say that commonly about research. There's always flaws in research. No research is perfect. There's always some holes in research, right? And it's always a question of, is there more faith you can have in it or less based on how many flaws there are in it? There's always something. That's one thing. Fraud is an entirely different thing. And it's, I don't know that I've ever heard fraud leveled by a journal against a researcher like that before.
I can't think of a time when anything like this has happened, at least in the kind of research that we read. For a journal to not just retract a study, even for a journal to retract a study, I think is pretty rare.
That's pretty rare. And
to
then
retract a study, and
the
now
British
to say that
Medical
it's
Council pulls his license. He can't practice as a doctor anymore. I mean, there's so many people that have looked at some of what this reporter has uncovered and just decided
And so one of the things
beyond the pale.
One of the things that you hear in response to this is that, well, you know, with this anonymous research, there's no oversight. How can people ever check that the data in the study is matching up with the actual information that was gathered? But you know, I don't think that's the problem. I think where that those kinds of things come out in the wash when you attempt to duplicate the research findings.
Right. I guess Dr. Wakefield himself is saying that it has been replicated 5 times around the world.
But nobody else is saying that except him. It's not like he's giving us his references for that.
No, he's not.
But that's how these things come out. If you fake your data, nobody else is going to be able to replicate your findings because they're not real findings. Well, nobody else has been able to replicate this guy's findings.
That's the balance and check in the system.
Exactly. Right? So it's not like you have to give away all of the medical information to prevent this kind of fraud from happening. This kind of thing would come out in the wash just from it not being...
And I guess it took 12 12, 13 years to come out in the wash.
Well, I think the problem was the media got a hold of it, and that there were already anti-vaccination groups that felt like this fit in with their message that they wanted to give, and celebrities are coming on saying,
"My child." A lot of anxious parents would like to have an answer.
A lot of anxious parents are hoping for some cause that maybe they can deal with, or maybe that there'll be a cure that comes out of this, or they can prevent someone else's autism by... I mean, what's happening now is that childhood diseases are coming back that were gone before because
that's
people are afraid
tragedy.
To get their kids vaccinated.
Well, that's it. And what you're really talking about is some deadly diseases. It's a life and death thing in the end, you know. It's a very serious accusation against this Dr. Wakefield. If all these things are true, I mean, these are really, really serious allegations. Kids have died as a result of not taking these vaccines. Not large numbers of kids, but some kids have. And so it's very, very serious allegations.
I think what it... I mean, outside of those serious repercussions and all of these allegations that are going on, I think what this needs to remind us of is that you can't read a newspaper story about a research study and take that as the gospel truth. You need to maybe talk to someone about it or read the source. You can't take one study with a small group of people and say, this is absolutely the way that it must be.
A small group of people that you handpicked.
Well, whether you handpick them or not, though, a small group of people. You know, what we do here at Family Anatomy, I think, is important for that reason, because we try to go to the original source. We try to figure out what the studies mean and what the practical implications are. And the fact is, the studies in general, the studies that and the information that we choose to share fits with what we know from our training and from our work with families. So if we're talking about a smaller study that says, hey, if your kid has a bad dream, it's okay to hug him, well, that makes sense to me as a therapist. And so if there's research that says that too, well, I'm probably more likely to believe that, even if it is with a small group, of course. And at the end of the day, I think that kind of thing is pretty harmless. In fact, it's helpful because it's relationship building.
Well, yeah. I mean, we're trying to build our practice on tried and true things from research, but obviously there's a lot of information that comes from clinical experience, from clinical data that comes from research too. I mean, Freud didn't look at hundreds and hundreds of people and then generalize. Right, in one study,
no.
He did a lot of clinical in-depth things with certain people, right? And a lot of interesting, very useful things came out of that. So we're not saying at all clinical data is not helpful. But on the other hand, you know, you can't necessarily generalize from a small, non-randomized sample. You can generalize from a larger randomized sample, and that's what the experimental method is about.
Exactly. And on that note, we'll come to the end of our first Three Things episode in a while, a kind of a controversial thing at the end, but I just found that whole thing to be so fascinating that such a thing could happen that I thought it was worth talking about.
And from thing one and thing two
to thing three, the podcast,
you can visit us at familyanatomy.com. And you can email us at info@familyanatomy.com.
You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. And as usual, we'll leave you with a bit of a tune by Brother Love. He's over at brotherloverocks.com. See you in 2 weeks.
And thanks for listening.
FamilyAnatomy.com